6. I spoke to the children here about Ezekiel. And perhaps that's a story that you're familiar with. It is not an often heard story for whatever reason. Maybe over time you've heard of the dry bones. You certainly, some of you old folks, you guys know the song, them bones, them dry bones, right? Hear the word of the Lord. You guys know that's right from the scriptures of Ezekiel. It is talking about this exact place that Ezekiel has brought out. A little background story. There are a number of, thousands of people that were carried away from Jerusalem and the country of Judah into this land of Babylon. Now, the northern kingdom, which we're going to hear about in a little bit from Hosea, the northern kingdom is already done. They're already finished. They've been taken, swept away by the Assyrians. And now that big, bad group of the Assyrians, who we thought were the greatest and the worst of the worst, they now are being swept away by an even bigger juggernaut, and that being Babylon. And Babylon has come and has knocked on the doors of Jerusalem. And this time, God said, you know what? I am going to use Babylon as a tool to bring my people back. Listen to that, because that's going to be really important for these next 6 weeks that you understand. The heart of God is that he not just simply punish. This is not a punishment as such. It is a chastising, a calling back to. And he says, I'm going to use this instrument for my great glory to bring my people back to me. He doesn't do it so he can cut them off. He doesn't do it so he can just forget about them, send them over there so they get out of my land. No, the whole earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Yes? And so for him to send them off to Babylon is simply a tool that he uses to grab a hold of the heart of his people. And I would ask you, even as we just jump into this sermon series today, what is God using to grab a hold of your heart? And then the next question that you're going to have to just wrestle with for these next weeks is, are you willing? Are you willing to hear that? Are you willing to respond and say, yes, Lord, I'm yours? You see, here we have Ezekiel, who is a prophet. He's been given a very difficult job. These stubborn, rebellious, captive people have been sent off now to Babylon. And it has been his job, this young man, Ezekiel, this young Judean, who is now, he's also one of the captives, but he's been given a job to preach to the captives. And in the midst of it, and you can read, Ezekiel's a pretty hefty book. We're in, this story is now in chapter 37 of that hefty book. And God has both spoken to his people and why these things have happened, but he's also comforting them, wooing them back, saying, this is the God that I am. Have you forgotten me? Because I have not forgotten you. Will you remember me? Because I remember you with every breath that I take. The Lord God remembers his people. And he has set up all of creation. He has set up all of time, all the entire timeline of creation in order to glorify himself and use his people to do that. So we are a major part of his story. And what I want you to get out of today is really just the heart of God. The heart of God's, the cry of God's heart on your behalf, on my behalf, on the behalf of his people and his church. And how he woos us and says, come. Come back to me. And so listen in this story in Ezekiel chapter 37, you know, he says, you know, I'm going to take you out to a place. And he goes out, as I was telling the children before, he takes them out to a dry and weary place. And perhaps, you know, on my journeys in this past little while, these last couple of weeks, Ann and I have been able to be out here. Now, this is probably about the area of what it would look like down in that Middle Eastern southern section. Okay, this is southern Israel. Okay, and he says, look out here in this valley. And there's a mighty battle had gone on here, perhaps, most likely. All these dead bodies everywhere, but they had long, long ago, lost all their flesh, all their sinews, everything. They were just bones, dry bones, by the thousands. The sun had bleached them out, and they were as dead could be. But I want you to see something in Ezekiel chapter 37 that he says, Ezekiel, I want you to preach to these dry bones. And when you preach to these dry bones, I want you to watch and see not what your words do, but what I do. Ezekiel's words of prophecy, these words from this pulpit have no power at all except by the very fact that God would will them to. And so he tells Ezekiel to speak to the dry bones, and as he speaks and he prophesies, he hears that rattle I was telling the kids about, that rattle of bones, and they're coming together. He's like, all of a sudden, the bones start coming together. Now, I don't know if this is a vision. I don't know if this is something real. I don't know if he was swept away to a certain place. This is a pretty cool thing, no matter what. It's things that we could certainly make a movie out of, right? And you can see some serious CGI, and the bones kind of rattling together, and they're coming together, and they're starting to meet each other right exactly where they're supposed to. Now, how in the world that happens is this guy's arm got hewn off over here on the other side of the battle, and his bone comes flying across the battleground, I suppose, and gets knocked back into the place where its original place was, and all of a sudden, we have skeletons, not just piles of bones, but skeletons, full-bodied skeletons. And God says, that's not enough. I want you to see something more. Because if you will speak it, I will start to do something mighty and amazing before you. I'm going to start to put on sinews into the, that is, musculature and places where the bones aren't just like touching each other. Now they're attached to each other. And then he starts to do that, and it's certainly enough. The sinews start coming back into the bones. And then the skin starts coming back onto the bones. What an amazing picture that God has given to us. He says, if you feel as dead and as dry and as helpless and hopeless as you possibly could be, it's not over until I say it's over. And I can revive who I will revive. And I will speak unto who I will speak unto. And if you today, you're feeling dry and you're feeling weary and you're feeling a little musty, a little bit dank, a little bit under, you know, like you just think it's this is it. God is speaking to your spirit today. He says, listen, and I'll prophesy over you, God says. And I'll speak life into places where you don't think there's any life. He says, see, I will do this. I will bring about, not your words, Eric, not your words, Ezekiel, but I will do this. Trust upon the Lord with all your heart and allow him to do this mighty thing among us in these next weeks as we talk about what it means to be revived in spirit. So the flesh doesn't, it's not just that the flesh comes back, but he says, once again, he says, prophesy to them. And I will bring the breath of life into these beings. And Ezekiel, I'm not sure exactly what in the world could be going through his mind. He doesn't really express it too much in the chapter there. I mean, I can imagine he was just blown away, but he continues to do what he's called to do. And these bones come together, and the sinews come out, and the flesh comes on, and they stand up, and he says, now I will breathe upon them. And God wants to breathe a fresh newness of life into our body here at Amherst, into our lives, into everything that we do and the things that we do for the glory of God. He wants to breathe special new life into you. And perhaps you've gone and you said, yeah, you know, I've lived this Christian world and everybody and everything has let me down. All my friends have turned, all that stuff is gone, and it's just so much has been piled upon me and so much down in the dirt I feel. And God's like, I want to breathe new life into you. I want to revive you. I want to speak life into places where you think there's no possibility of life. And if you feel like you're in a place of dry bones in your life, right around the corner from this picture is this picture. So Anna and I were out just meandering through the desert, kind of, and we find ourselves in what's called En Gedi. And En Gedi is a special place in the Bible. We'll talk about it someday, but it's an oasis in the midst of the desert. Now, that desert goes on for miles and miles and hundreds of miles. It's the full span of the Dead Sea. If you look on a map and you look at the geography around it, it's called the Dead Sea for a reason. It is a salty, dead place. And that salt sea at one time crept up far more than it is today, and all it left behind it was death. Death and desert and dryness. And we have some very special people in our Bible that have found themselves in this wilderness. David is the one that we see in En Gedi. He was running away for his life. He was in the dry bones valley, if you will, running for his life in the wilderness. When the Bible says wilderness, this is what he's talking about. Dryness. But when God says revival, he says, I've got something special for you, and it might be right in the middle of the dryness and the dry bones that you feel like you're in. And sometimes it's just turning the corner, and all of a sudden you find a fresh spring. And this is not the only beautiful waterfall in En Gedi. This waterfall goes all the way up in the mountains. It's one waterfall after another waterfall after another waterfall, fresh. And if you look at this, if you're interested, we're going to be doing some pictures this next Wednesday at Spinoff. I'll be going through some of that. But Anna and I, if you were to ask Anna what her favorite thing of our trip was this past time, it was En Gedi. An amazing little oasis. Everything to the left and everything to the right of this picture is complete desert. You wouldn't even guess it right there, would it? It looks like a little paradise. But in the midst of the worst conditions, God can bring revival, refreshment, renewal into your life. And I'm going to be speaking to some of you you've never thought about these things ever before. Some of you, you've not thought about this for a long, long time. Others of you, you've walked a Christian life, and you've yourselves gotten a little bit dry and crusty. And that's okay. I mean, that's part of the cycle of life, even in spirituality. We walk and we get it. I needed a trip to En Gedi, honestly. I need times of refreshment. I did this, not just to be a tourist. If you're asking me about my trip, we did everything to get away from everybody. We walked into places like this, and we walked up mountains to get away from everybody that was normal. We wanted to be away. We wanted to study. We wanted to pray. We wanted to see God, and that was a refreshment. So I'm coming off of this time saying, we need that. This is not a one-time. Revival is not a one-time thing in our lives. We wake up every day, and we say, revive me, O God. I need your refreshment upon my life. And sometimes in difficult times in the valleys, we say it in a little different way, right? It's like, God, I've been down here for a while. This desert is a lot. And I need you. Oh, God, revive me. Restore me. I am so in need of you. And there lies the biggest issue, isn't it? Some of us will walk out of here today and you'll never understand. You won't even stop and grasp the fact that we are so very needy of this. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Poor in spirit says, I am bankrupt. I have nothing to offer. I need you, God. And yes, I need your revival. And yes, I need your spoken word into my life. So let's turn to Hosea chapter 6 and see what the Lord has to say. The These next 6 weeks, we're going to be looking at six different minor prophets. Again, not particularly pieces of scripture that we delve into in this length, but that's okay. Minor prophets, do you know why they're called minor prophets? It's not because they have less to say, less important things to say. It just means that their books are smaller than the major prophets. So Ezekiel, we just talked about, is a major prophet. It's got many, many, many chapters, right? It's large in content. Isaiah, large in content. The minor prophets, they do with a lot less words, and therefore they're minor. There's 12 of them. We're not going to be hitting all 12 of them, but it's about six of them in the next 6 weeks. Today, it's Hosea. And Hosea is a Judean prophet who is given the job. Each one of these prophets has been given a job. And the prophets often have a thankless job, right? Because they're out there to speak truth into darkness, light into darkness, truth into falsehoods, into Baal worship, into all kinds of garbage that's going around. And so Hosea is living now well before the time of Ezekiel. Northern kingdom is still around. Okay? I'm not going to take a lot of time to give you a biblical history lesson here, but hopefully we, with a few things, maybe I'll just refresh some of your memory. We have a lousy king, King Saul, to start out with, right? He starts out kind of good, and then he kind of goes really crazy. He starts throwing spears at people. David the king comes along. He's the guy that's in Gedi, right? Running for his life from Saul, the crazy king. So David is given his anointed king. David takes over, and he becomes a great king. They are still today in Israel, just outside Jerusalem. They are unearthing David's palace in incredible fashion. It is called the City of David. If you ever go, you need to take a look at that. It is amazing how they just recently have found signet rings and such like that that really specify biblical principles. It's really, really been an excellent excavation. David is a man of war, and he expands the territory, and his son Solomon comes in. We know him as the wisest of the kings, right? And yet he himself becomes a fool in the midst of his kingship, and he marries all kinds of foreign wives, and in that it changes his heart. Because of that, this kingdom, when it's handed down to his son Rehoboam, it is split into two. There's a great rebellion, and the ten tribes go to in the north. And then we have basically the one and a half tribes called Judah in the south. Judah being the southern kingdom, the northern kingdom being everything else. Now along comes several other kings, and we are now looking in Hosea at a time, around the same time as, we'll say, Isaiah, okay? Isaiah and Hosea are contemporaries, and they preach to similar kings in Judah. But Hosea's first job is to speak to what's going on in the north. He's a southern king speaking things to the north. If I have bored you already, I apologize, and we will move on from that. But that just gives you a little bit of context. He is speaking about all the falsehood and all the Baal worship and all the difficulties that the northern kingdom has been resounding in. And you can go today and you can travel to some of these sites where the old Baal worshiping and the shrines used to be up in the hillsides, right? And they would stick them up there. And God says, that is completely against my word. That is against my ways and my people, my loved people of Israel. I need to do something to bring you back to me. Judah was already starting to dabble in this. But they had some kings that brought them back in line, right? Like Hezekiah and Josiah later on. But the northern kingdom, if you look across its litany of kings, it has no king that brings them back in line. So they are a rebellious people from the start. They rebelled against the family of David and that kingship. So that in itself kind of caused them to have a rebellious spirit. And they're into all kinds of, they have no lineage, no line, nobody to pass the things down to. They just find one lousy king after another. One of those is Ahab, okay? And Ahab kind of is the guy that we know best as being just horrible. And it just keeps on going down and downhill, right? And suddenly God brings about a punishment or a chastisement, and it's in the name of Assyria. Hosea speaks to this, and he tells them that Assyria is coming. Assyria is going to do this, but I want you to understand, my people, he says. I am not doing this to destroy you. I am doing this to bring you back to me, to grab a hold of your heart so that your heart and my heart can once again be true to each other, that you be true to me. And I could not have asked for a better tie-in than what Mike did last week, talking about the Chesed God, okay? This God of faithful love, loyalty. And this Chesed God just shows up in Hosea like it's difficult to see it as obvious as in any other place, okay? So Hosea is told as a prophet, he says, by God, God says, go and I want you to take for yourself a promiscuous wife. This is in the first chapter of Hosea. It's a wife that's out there and is flaunting herself sexually. And I want you to go and I want you to find her. And can you imagine a good Jewish man? And you know, it's like, why would you tell me this? It's like, I want you to do this because this is a symbol of my love for my people. And my people are a desperate and adulterous people. But I want you to go because, not because I want to show how bad they are, that's already known. Not how bad Israel is, the northern kingdom, and how bad soon to be the southern kingdom is. It's not just that. It's more than that. I want to show my faithfulness, my chesed love for you, my faithfulness and my loyalty to you. No matter what happens, no matter how dry you are, no matter how far you've wandered, he says, I want to show you my incredible love for you, to draw you back to myself. Go and take this promiscuous wife. And so he does. And he has three children. And you can read down chapters 1 and 2, and you can see he's got some amazing names. One girl's name is You Are Not Mine. That seems kind of harsh. How do you like that as a name? You know? And he goes on, and he says, I'm going to name these children because they are exactly the way that Israel has treated me. And this is the way that they want to be seen, apparently. They have flaunted themselves and they have pushed me away and they have done everything that I've told them not to do. And God says, I love them anyways. I would do anything for them. In fact, Hosea's wife leaves him, bears him three children, and then goes away and prostitutes herself once again. God says, I want you to go. I want you to find your adulterous wife and I want you to take her back. I want you to, and it wasn't an easy thing. He had to go and buy her back. His wife, who had turned away, basically slapped him in the face, did everything that you could possibly imagine would break a Hebrew man's heart, and went and sold himself out, and God says, I want you to go and find her. She's in a bad place. You can make her beg, but I ask you, go and pay for her and bring her back whole and make her whole. Because this is the love that I have for you, my people. The faithful, loyal, never-ending love of God screams out to us. And so that is the part where we come to in Hosea chapter 6. If you read through the first parts of Hosea, it's almost like God has two children. He's got the northern kingdom, Israel, he's got the southern kingdom. And the northern kingdom is really rebellious and way out there. Judah is watching Israel and kind of biting at the bit like, man, that looks like a cool life. You ever have one of those two kids in your family and the one is really way out there and kind of just like straying away and the second one is looking at it, it's like, man, I know this is in Father's heart, but it's looking pretty good. And that's what was happening in the first parts of Hosea. Isaiah was on its way to utter destruction in order to bring them back. And as if you listen to the words of God through Hosea, the southern kingdom, the younger brother will say, is looking up and they're following suit. They're several steps behind. They get brought back into line, as I said, by some good kings. But ultimately, their journey is the same. They look up and they see this quote-unquote great, glorious, sinful, godless life. And they chase after. So by the time we get to Hosea chapter 6, we're looking at really the both brothers. God is really speaking prophecy over both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And, you know, in chapter 5, you can look at that and you can see, man, there is some harsh words being spoken here by the father. And he says that, you know, he's torn them like a lion. Like he gives himself this personality of a lion wandering about and tearing up the children, northern kingdom, southern kingdom. Now, when he says tear them up, he's using Assyria and Babylon to do this. He says he's tearing them up. But when we get to chapter 6, it will make a lot more sense to you because this is not just a vicious, horrible, punishing God that we're talking about. He says, I have torn you so that I may what? So that I may heal you. I have wounded you so that I can bind you up, comfort you. But see, as long as you're out there, I can't even reach you. I can't comfort you if you want nothing to do with me. But I have truth and I have life and I have goodness and I have breath of great things for you if you will come back. And so he tore them and he wounded them. And he caused their eyes to start to turn back to him. There's a simple three verses that I want to cover. But look at this with me. Chapter 6, verse 1 in Hosea. Come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us, and he will heal us. Some of your versions say, so that he may heal us. He has wounded us, and he will bind us up and bind up our wounds. He will revive us after 2 days, and on the third day he will raise us up so we can live in his presence. Let us strive to know the Lord. His appearance is as sure as the dawn. He will come to us like the rain, like the spring showers the water into that water the land. It all ends up as virtually every prophetic utterance does. It ends up in the hands of the Chesed God. The faithful, tender, loving kindness. Yes, I will allow this to happen to you so that you will return to me and so that you would be mine and that we can enjoy the presence of each other once again. This is what revival is about. It's not some hocus pocus that we just like speak upon somebody's head and we just say, you know, now you've got it. You've got the revival. We think it's some kind of, you know, over the years we've seen revival as it's has been indicated through either churches or other things. We've had revivals here. And the concept there is not that it's like this happening, right? It's that God is starting to stir. He's starting to stir in our hearts to bring us back to him. That is when revival happens. When your heart turns to him, then revival is a practical thing to talk about. We see here in the very first thing, the word here, come. Come is the invitation. God's crying out for the return of his people. And today, you know, perhaps you looked at the title and you thought perhaps that it was talking about our cry for revival. The cry, and I purposely did that because I want us to think about the cry of the heart is from God. It's his cry. It ought to be our cry. We ought to be crying out towards him as well. And that's when revival begins. When we understand the cry of his heart and we start to enjoin his heart in the same cry. You need me. And my heart responds, I need you. I am desperate for you. Revive me, O God. That's when revival starts. So he said, it starts out, of course, this is through the words of the prophet. And he says, come, let us return to the Lord. Don't forget, every word is here. It is breathed through the very nostrils of God, right? And so even though it's a prophet that's speaking and saying, come, let us return to the Lord, it's God's voice saying, come, return to me. Please, I beg you, my children, come back to me. And so here we are in the dry and desert land of whatever we find ourselves. And listen, I'm not saying that we're all, you know, desperately evil and sinful and we're down in the dust. Some of us can probably be there. But that's not the point. The point is wherever you are, where your heart grows and it's fading and it's becoming difficult to feel rejuvenated and you're finding yourself difficult to get up in the morning because you don't have the purpose and you don't have the willpower and you can't put it all together. I can't put the sinews back into myself. I can't put the flesh back on myself, and I certainly can't breathe the life back into myself. That's why God says, come. Let me show you how I can do that for you. I have an amazing revival awaiting for you if you would just come. Return to me. So we get ourselves kind of carried away. We find ourselves following things of the world. I'm a Christian man, and yet I can get carried away by things of the world, and my heart grows dry. Dusty, spiritually, I'm just out there and I can't figure out what I'm doing anymore. God says, come, return to me. Return to your loving chesed God, the one who's faithful and loyal to you. Eric, even though you stumble and you fall and you find yourself so parched, calling to you, return to me. And so this is any level of desperation. If you're waking up and you're like, I've been living for Christ for a long, long time. Yeah, okay. As many of us have. But that doesn't mean that you're not desperate. You ought to be more desperate. It's okay to be desperate. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Be willing to be desperate for the call of God and the invitation. So when he says, return to me, we hear that and we say, yes, yes, that's where I belong. I love that he wants me. It says he has torn us, but that's not his desire. His desire is not to tear you. His desire is not to wound you. His desire is to heal us and to bind up our wounds. Why would I go to a God who is looking to tear me apart? Of course, that's not what he wants to do. The prophecy is clear about that. We're going to return to the Lord because he has already torn us. He has torn us in order to grab a hold of us. He has wounded us in order to gather us together with him and so that he may heal us. He's the only one that can heal us. You've been wounded by church. He's the only one that can heal you. You've been wounded by family. He's the only one that can heal you. We can help. We can come alongside. We can encourage you. But ultimately, it's the revival of God in your life that will bring healing to your bones. And I'm talking spiritually, mentally, emotionally. Allow the greatness of our God to revive us. Hear the call, take the invitation, and come. Second verse, he will revive us after 2 days. On the third day, he will raise us up so that we can live in his presence. A clear foreshadowing, if you will, of Jesus Christ, right? Coming out of the ground in 3 days. I think we can see that. But this is a common literary way that the prophets spoke, and you'll see this oftentimes in the Psalms as well. For two times I did this, and oh, for three times, and they'll add on. It's for emphasis and for added context, I guess you could say, for emphasis on that. And, you know, this very verse is likely to be the piece that is used when people talk about, hey, it was spoken of in the prophets that on the third day he would rise again. Ever wonder where that was actually said? You know, Peter uses that in the book of Acts. Well, perhaps this is exactly, I mean, it's not a word-for-word rendering of it, but this is definitely something. Well, what is the point to the people he's talking to here? It's talking about revival. He will revive us after 2 days. On the third day, he will raise us up, and we can live in his presence. By what power are you going to be revived? I will put the sinews together. I will put the skin upon them. I will breathe the breath into him. It's only by the power of Christ that this can happen. He will revive us. Come back to him. Return to him. And he will return to you and revive you in 2 days. And then you can live in his presence. He has the power to raise me up, to set me on my feet, to give me purpose and focus. One of the ways that I'm learning to pray for you as a body of Christ in these last weeks has been to look at the prayers of Paul and the way he prays for his people in the Scriptures. And one of the things that he always, always prays for is that we have a certain focus, a concentration of the things that God has done. It is so much more important for us to be praying for each other in the spiritual context than virtually any other context there is. Oh, that you may have a mindset for God, that you would understand that the power of Christ is the only thing that's going to get you through this day. The power of Christ, be centered on him, be focused on him. Understand the great power and the hope and the love of God in that. So much more important than all the other stuff that we so often prioritize in our prayer time. Oh, that we would have a focus upon the greatness of God and his power. He has the power to raise me up. He has the power to breathe new life into me. And so when I'm, you know, I've been doing this job, and you know, any one of us, it's a minister, I look at Jason over here, ministry on the campus is difficult. I think about my brother Jerry Gillis up there at the chapel, and I sometimes just weep for that man because there's so much on his shoulders. And I have to pray for him. I pray for him so much because there's so much upon him. And our other pastors and our ministers, there's so much that we can find ourselves waking up sometime and we are just dry. Well, where's the power going to come from to raise us up, to give us purpose, to get back on the campus, to get back into the pulpit, to be in study? Where does that come from? Well, if we don't pray that into each other's lives, if we're not praying that for ourselves, if we're not seeking the revival, you are going to be seeing one pastor after another pastor after another pastor continue to fall off, because that is what's going to kill a pastor. That's what's going to kill a minister. Relying upon my own power, it's futile. It's ridiculous, actually, when you think about it. If we're talking about revival in the mindset of what Ezekiel went through and seeing the bones coming together and stuff, what in the world? What power do I have for that? I don't have that in my life. I don't have that power in your life. All I can do is sit here and see what God has spoken and illuminate that upon my heart, help to illuminate that upon our hearts so that we can together grow in Christ in this and rely upon the great power of Christ to do these things. So he gives us this opportunity to have life breathed back into us. He revives us so that we can be in his presence. Do you see how these clauses keep on ending? If you look through the book of Hosea and several of these other prophets, you're going to see that this is done, so what? What's the point? What's the end line? So that you can be finally gotten back into order? No. Just so that you can figure out that God was right and you were wrong? No. that he could just put you in your place and knock you down a few pegs? No. So that he could be in your presence. So that we can be in his presence. Do you understand the cry of God's heart is for intimacy? And look at this next piece in verse 3. Let us strive to know the Lord. His appearance is as sure as the dawn, and he will come to us like the rain, like the spring showers that water the land. Rain comes to Israel, but one time a year. We just happened to be there at the very beginning of it, but we didn't actually have much rain. It's actually a very dry period right now. And so when things dry up, it gets bad. They survive, their agriculture survives by the great rains that would come. And so when things start drying up, agriculture dries up. And life is not sustainable. Cattle have no place to eat grass. They have everything starts going badly. This has been the age-old story of Israel. It's always been this way. Why in the world would God take a piece of dry ground, a desert area for the most part, and give it to his people and say, this is my promised land? Well, there is. There's great agriculture in some places. Jezreel Valley, beautiful, beautiful. We looked at it from up on top, and you can look at this beautiful valley below. Beautiful agriculture. It gets dried up, though. Guess what? Not so beautiful. And God says, you know what? You understand how desperate you are for the day-to-day rain. That's why I want you here. But you're just starting to grow in understanding of how desperate you are for my presence, for my appearing. And my appearing is not like the rains. Earlier on in chapter 5, he says, your love for me is like the little cloud that dissipates early in the morning. But my love for you is faithful and loyal and true right to the end. My love for you will not go away. And it is, what does he say here? His appearance is sure as the dawn, and it will come to us like the rain, like the spring showers that water the land. God is not me. God is not you. In our lack of faithfulness, he says, I am faithful. In my lack of being able to produce any kind of hope, he is hope. And so he brings to us this great reputation of love and truth. And he wants our minds and our hearts to be familiarized with that. You see, when we get dry and we get crusty and we get dusty, we have grown unfamiliar with the great loyalty and faithfulness and love of God. So frequently, that is exactly what it's going to take for us to be watered again, is to relax and fall back into the arms of how good our chesed God really is, our loving, compassionate, caring, kind, gentle, faithful, you name it. That word is who God is. And he says, come, I want you to know me. I want you to know me intimately as my people. You can see this. If you're listening and you can look through the Old Testament, we so often we kind of pen God off in the Old Testament as being this grumpy old man who just had war on his mind. He just had to keep on destroying people. And honestly, we could not be further from the truth. This loving, faithful, compassionate God is throughout. His love does not change. It has not changed from one testament to the other. It is expressed maybe somewhat differently. But ultimately, he is the same God. And he has loved you since the beginning of time. And he has created you for a purpose that exists before time began. He built what was going to go into you. And you've been on his mind. And you think that that God is just looking to cut you off? You think that God is just trying to set you aside and do away with you? Or do you think that God is calling out to you? And he's saying, come, return to me. Turn your heart towards me. Return to me so that I may know you and that you may know me. that you may know the great compassion of my heart towards you, the great salvation, that you may know me in the innermost parts of my being, as I know you, as I knitted you together in your mother's womb. I want you to have a heart that knows me. But so frequently we withstand revival, awakening, however you want to say it, coming to Christ, even for the first time, we put it aside because we think all we have to do is know here. This is not the end of it. Your mind, your understanding here has to burgeon something here in your heart for a love of that great God. So that your mind, heart, drives and strives to know this incredible, beautiful, loving God. So that's the challenge for today. Are you ready to strive? Are you ready to, as it says there in verse 3, let us strive to know him? Are you ready for that? Are you ready to engage this great God? What is it going to take? What does it look like when it happens? You can look down through your notes. You got three things. This is not the end of that list, but this is three things that we can look for. What does revival look like in me? It looks like a wholehearted returning to God. There are things that you probably know in your heart that you need to turn away from and turn back to God. I confessed some things up here several weeks back about a movie, I think, that I had spoken to my son about, and I was very convicted. Even as I was preaching, I was convicted, and I have allowed that to really take root in my heart. Listen, when I'm up here preaching, I am not preaching at you. I am preaching to myself first and foremost, and more than I am preaching to you. I don't know if a single one of you hears what I'm saying. You're kind of drooling out there, so it's a little difficult for me to tell. But don't understand this, that when I am speaking, I am speaking here. And so when I speak things, I am taking them and I'm allowing God to do those things in my heart. And there are things those violent kind of shows that sometimes I just get, you know, I guess it's the manly man thing or something like that. There are things I have to turn off in my brain so that I can get back into a fellowship with God that is deeper than it was before. And that's just for me. I'm not pointing at you and saying, why are you watching those things? I'm saying God's speaking that into my heart. And if I respond by saying no, then I get dry and crusty. And whatever it is that God is speaking into your heart, and he's saying, listen, I want you to return to me. I want you to do this. This is going to be an endless, lifelong situation. He wants to revive. He wants to bring us back. He wants to ignite something new, enlighten us. Day by day, that's what the walk of a Christian is. And so he shows something in my life, and I can say no, and I can grow crusty, or I can say yes, and I can allow him to refresh me and to pour his spirit into me. And so when I'm asking the question, am I ready to strive? I'm saying yes, and I'm putting one foot in front of the other and saying, absolutely, God, you show me the next thing. He's shown me, in this trip, he had shown me letters that I needed to write. He has shown me things that I needed to do. And every chance I had, I could have said no. But what a foolish thing that would be. When the God of all creation is chastening me and calling me and lovingly saying, I want intimacy with you. And what's my response going to be? No? Oftentimes it is, isn't it? And so we remain crusty and dry. And God says, come. Return to me. Come. Say yes. What does that look like in my life? Wholehearted returning. Secondly, I'm not going to have time to go through these, but an empowering heart. We'll talk more about these in weeks to come. And thirdly, a heart knowledge of God. We've touched upon each of these and the results of these. We've talked about them even in this sermon. But we'll get more into this as the weeks go on. Olivia's going to come, and she's going to just give us a time of contemplation today. This will be the final moments of this service as she finishes up this one song. And it's really just for us to sit and contemplate, not so much the words, but as contemplate what God is calling us to. And at that point, you'll be dismissed to DNA. All right? Thank you.